Our next case this morning is number 04-2993, Green against Butler. Mr. Werber.
May it please the court, Mr. Hazag. This case involves the constitutional requirement that government agents knock and announce their authority and purpose before entering a private dwelling in the absence of exigent circumstances. As the court is aware, my client, Michael Green, owns a single-family home out in Warrenville, Illinois, where he lives with my other client, Cheryl Polson. About 3 years ago, in May of 2002, they decided to allow a family friend of Mr. Green's named Michael Belter, who was on parole with the Illinois Department of Corrections, to live with them. They told him, though, before he moved in, they said, we have one rule. Don't allow anyone in the house when we're not here. And he said, okay. And Mr. Belter moved in May of 2002. Now, in February of the next year is the date in question. What happened, two parole agents came out to the house, and Mr. Belter, came out onto the porch, and the parole agents had come out for a routine visit. They said, we'd like to come in the house. He said, you can't come in because the owner's not here.
Mr. Wimmer, I wonder if we could jump ahead, because we all are familiar with what you've recounted in your briefs and what the government has. My question is, first of all, in light of the purposes of the knock and announce rule, opportunity to comply with the law, avoid destruction of property, prepare for an entry, and so on and so forth. In light of what happened precisely here with the garage door open, with Mr. Green in the garage, with no one broke doors down or anything, even under the most dim view of the facts, and with the overlay of the fact that this was a situation where no warrant was needed, where it's just a generic reasonableness inquiry, why, at a minimum, do we not have qualified immunity for these officers? And at a maximum, why don't we say that the district court was correct to say this is really just reasonableness as a whole, and there are many things that might have made this unreasonable, but none of them happened. There was rudeness of taking the facts as you described them, but nothing beyond that.
The reason you don't have qualified immunity is that after Richardson versus Wisconsin was decided in 1997, I think that any competent parole officer or police officer would have known that there was a requirement that he knock and announce unless he had a reasonable suspicion.
But Richardson's not a parole officer case.
No, it's a police officer case. But
And doesn't that already, since there are a lot of rules anyway that are different for parole officers, you're arguing not this one, and you may be right, but the Supreme Court has never actually said that.
Well, the Supreme Court has said that the Fourth Amendment protects parolees.
It does, and the Supreme Court has also said there's no need for a warrant, and at its bottom, the Fourth Amendment is about reasonableness, but that's what I'm trying to get to. If this is an overall assessment of reasonableness, as the district court thought it was, the district court said the failure to knock and announce was certainly a factor to take into account, but he didn't see it in the end as a dispositive factor.
Well, I think Richardson did say that before the government comes into a private home, they have to have a reasonable suspicion that there's some law enforcement interest which would be compromised if they knocked and announced. And there was none here. I mean, Mr. Carroll had time to shove aside Mr. Green and say, this is what you get for not cooperating. He could have just as easily said, we're with the Illinois Department of Corrections. We need to speak with the owner of the home.
Is the record well enough developed in this case, in your opinion? I mean, I gather that at least one of the parole officers was wearing a bulletproof vest. Is that correct?
I think I have my file over there. That was Amy Freund, and I think she said she had a sweatshirt over or under it. I'm not sure. I'd have to check. That was in the portion of the Rule 56.1 statement of the government under Amy Freund. Mr. Green said he didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
And the other thing, the government's argument is really, and the futility, they say they had a reason to believe that Mr. Green and the people inside the house knew who they were. The evidence is to the contrary.
Yeah, you win if the Richardson framework is applied unchanged to the parole context, because you can't say exigent circumstances or futility or anything. But if it's, in fact, in the parole context, only a factor going to overall reasonableness, when in this case, you know, the house is clearly open, the door is unlocked, they walk in, you know, all of the things that happened here. So I think we're at a fairly fundamental level here in terms of what's going on.
Well, I mean, one thing, the government didn't argue that the framework of Richardson does not apply, or the defendants, I should say. In fact, they structured their argument accepting the notion that Richardson applied. And so that's an issue that really hasn't been presented by the defense. I will state to Your Honor that two things Your Honor spoke about before, the purpose behind the knock and announce rule. One is to give the people inside the opportunity to prepare. And the evidence is Cheryl Polson had a basket of laundry in her hand when the door flew open. Her dog starts barking, and they say, shut up that dog or we're going to shoot it. So she didn't have time to prepare for the agents to come in. And they weren't given an opportunity to voluntarily turn over the private premises to the agents of the government.
But given that Butler and Bryan had told Belter, it's this like Peter Piper's pick,
yeah.
that they intended to return to the house, and given Belter's knowledge that they wanted to conduct a search, this wasn't a case in which the occupants of the house were caught completely off guard by the subsequent unannounced entry, was it?
That's true, Judge, but if Richards applies, they had to have a reasonable suspicion that the occupants of the house knew that they were agents of the government. If you tell someone, I'll be back later this afternoon, and then two strangers come in, you don't know if they're parole agents or if they're intruders or if they're friends of Michael Butler's or who they are.
But would you agree that that at least would mitigate any injury caused by the unannounced entry, even if it didn't eliminate it?
I don't think so, because until you know that they're government agents, you're not given an opportunity to voluntarily comply and prepare. I mean, as I say, Mrs. Polson didn't even know anyone was outside until the door flew open. And I see I reserved some time, so I believe my 7 minutes is up. And unless there's any other questions, I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wimmer. We hear now from Mr. Huzza.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, a counsel for the defendants, and I urge the court to affirm summary judgment in their favor in this case because within the context of an overall reasonableness inquiry regarding dispensing with a knock and announce procedure in this case, the evidence taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, given the posture of the case, establishes at the very minimum a reasonable suspicion by the defendants that the plaintiffs knew who they were and why they were there.
Understand that the officers presented themselves to Mr. Green in the garage, and he knew who they were.
Well, they're not mind readers,
and what they were there for. But if we accept the plaintiff's version of the facts, the officers did not truly identify themselves to Mr. Green, nor did they announce their intent to enter and search the house, did they?
Neither of those specific things occurred. We can see that.
And isn't that important? If they, taking the facts as the plaintiffs show them, Mr. Green sees a bunch of people come up and walk into the garage and behave rudely toward him and then barge in through the front door.
Well, in isolation, that's how they presented it.
But again, I mean, given the posture of the case, I'm confident that you would have other things to say. But if those are the facts that we have to accept, why is that reasonable?
I think the court has to also accept other facts in the context of the totality of the circumstances here. And that is the test. It's not whether we've proved that what Mr. Green knew with a certainty, nor is it that we establish even probable cause that he knew. The test is, the bar that the defendants have to satisfy is that they had a reasonable suspicion that he knew.
But we never use reasonable suspicion in that way. They would usually have to have a reasonable suspicion that there was evidence of a crime, or reasonable suspicion, in the Terry context, that the defendant is concealing a weapon or what have you. It's not reasonable suspicion about whether the person you're about to search knows you're a police officer.
I believe that the plaintiffs have conceded that standard in their briefing in this case,
but
and it's based upon... Well, if the court wishes to revisit the issue, the Supreme Court has said that the standard for determining the applicability of any of these recognized exceptions, and the court's recent decision in Leaf versus Shawnut goes into them at length, which are the risk of the imminent destruction of evidence or danger to the officers or persons inside, or also the futility exception, which has been described as a redundant and senseless gesture of repeating something that given the circumstances, the persons with Fourth Amendment interests would already know. And so, to return to your question about what the critical facts are here, it's more than just that they showed up and barged in rudely. And I think it's important to emphasize that the plaintiff knew that they had a parolee living with them, that he was subject to restrictions, including where he could live, and that they had come to the house and that they wanted to come inside and were turned away but were told they would come back later.
Do we know that either Mr. Green or Ms. Poulsen knew those things?
Yes, there is an inconsistency as to exactly who told Mr. Green, but it's immaterial. Mr. Belter said he spoke to Green directly on the phone when they were coming back from the hardware store. Mr. Green said he talked to Cheryl Poulsen, and she told me what he said, which is there were parole officers and they wanted to come in.
So anyone who shows up at the house at this point can just walk in?
No, certainly not.
Some guy from
Best again, Mr. Green's theory is, for all I knew at the time, these were nefarious intruders who'd showed up on that day of all days, even though he was told parole officers are coming back later today, and people do so. He saw 4 to 5 cars pull up at the end of the driveway. People get out, two wearing black shirts, walk up the driveway.
Garage. You know, this is a dangerous world out here.
Yes.
And even if people are expecting someone to come, if you don't know the people in advance, you're asking us to assume that anybody who shows up is automatically the expected one?
No, again, that's not the test. The test is reasonable suspicion.
Or even have a reason. I wouldn't. Would you?
They asked him, where's Belter? These aren't just some terrorists that, arrived out of a rocket ship.
But how to know that?
Again, the
how
test
to
isn't
know
to know.
You know.
If
how to even...
If somebody comes, if you come to the door and somebody slams the door in your face, you don't know that they know you're police officers, but you're entitled to draw reasonable inferences. And from these facts, the inferences are certainly sufficient to establish by a reasonable suspicion standard that Green, who said, when asked, where's Belter, he's in the house. And then he observed them one by one go through the front door as he followed them in. If these were, you know, nefarious intruders, you'd think, at least from the defendant's perspective, that at some point he would have said, stop, who
well,
are you,
well,
what are
wait.
You doing?
Maybe he expected, as do many judges, that the officers would have paused at the front door and, if not, at least knock, announce their intent to enter.
But the person, the only person they knew who was inside, there was no knowledge, no evidence that they knew Polson was in there. So going back to the purposes behind the rule, I think that evidence is beside the point.
But isn't it always a possibility that someone other than the parolee might be present? These officers didn't know who else might be living or visiting at the house.
But Belter had said
that there might even be a dog that somebody threatens to shoot. I mean, when you announce, you give whoever might be there, could have been his old grandmother, the ability to compose yourself before people come barging in.
Certainly there are privacy interests at stake in connection with any search of a residence, but those are not absolute, and they're subject to reasonable exceptions. And one of the exceptions is where, in this case, you have a parolee who has defied his commitment to allow searches of the residence by coming out the front door quickly, slamming it behind him and saying, you can't come in. First he said, there's a dog.
But we're not.
And then they said, get rid of the dog. And he said, well, the owner's not home.
What we're talking about, though, is not Belter. We're talking, your argument, which, you know, the district judge also alludes to, is essentially any normal citizen, not under any legal cloud, loses a certain amount of Fourth Amendment rights if a parolee is living under that person's roof.
That's true. There is a diminished expectation of privacy.
But unfortunately here, because Belter lied or something happened, who knows what, Green had never signed that agreement. For all we know, Green didn't even know there was an agreement.
We assume that he was not aware of it. The only evidence is that he was not aware of
right.
it, although
so
he did know he had a parolee.
You don't lose those rights.
Not entirely.
Until you sign the agreement and you consent to letting the parole officers.
We have argued in the alternative that the consent of the only person known to be in the residence is sufficient. But instead of relying upon that, because there is no unequivocal authority on that point, although a similar case has now been granted cert in that Georgia versus Randolph case, nonetheless, that's just a consent issue for conducting a search. With respect to the issue of the exception here, we have argued as an alternative that the consent of the only and awareness of the only person that was known to be in the residence is sufficient to satisfy that exception. But here we've doubly satisfied the exception by virtue of the evidence with respect to Green. His alternative, he says he admits that that it was possible that they were parole officers. He said parole officers were coming back that afternoon and all these people show up. But he says, for all I knew, they could have been nefarious intruders. Our position is that may be some remote possibility, but the standard that the defendants have to satisfy in these circumstances to fulfill their law enforcement functions is not a certainty, it's not clear and convincing evidence, it's not probable cause, it's a reasonable suspicion that the person whose Fourth Amendment interests are implicated knows who they are and why they're there, and there's no doubt that Belter told Green, parole officers are here, they want to come inside, and they're coming back. And that's exactly what happened. And the idea that these were, you know, nefarious intruders coming out of the blue on this day of all others, and that they show up and ask him, where is Belter? And Green says, he's in the house. And then watches them all walk in through the unlocked front door and follows them in without at any point saying, hey, wait a minute, stop, who are you? I think in these circumstances, especially given the diminished expectation of privacy and the overall reasonableness test.
Am I wrong in recalling that, at least according to the plaintiffs, Mr. Green did object upon their entry into the house?
No, that's a misstatement of the record, and the record, I think, absolutely establishes without doubt that minutes passed before.
Does he have to object?
He didn't have to, but his non-objection, again, confirms the defendant's reasonable suspicion that he knew who they were and why they were there, because they asked, where's Belter? And he said he's in the house, and he followed them in without ever complaining. So he didn't have to explicitly object or consent, but his silence corroborated the basis for them to have that reasonable suspicion that he was aware who they were and why they were coming.
Maybe he was in a state of shock.
Well,
or he thought he couldn't take on five people.
But I don't think that the plaintiff's state of mind is controlling, and really ultimately neither is the subjective state of mind of the defendants. It's an objective reasonableness standard based upon the evidence, and we believe that standard is satisfied. We urge the court to affirm the judgment, if not on this ground, certainly on qualified immunity grounds.
Thank you, Mr. Hussack.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Your
you.
Honors.
How much time does Mr. Wimmer have? A minute? We'll make that two, since we gave the government another minute.
Thank you, sir. A couple of points I wanted to make. The test is not whether the officers had a reasonable suspicion that the homeowner had a suspicion that they were government agents. The test is whether the police had a reasonable suspicion that the homeowner knew they were government agents. And when they come to the door and someone says, "It's the cops, shut the door," then you know they have a reasonable suspicion that the people know they're police. That's not what happened in this case. The other thing, there is no statement in the government or in the defendant's 56.1 statement to the effect that Mr. Green did not object as he followed them into the house. It doesn't appear, I believe, in the defendant's 56.1 statement, so there was no reason for me to controvert that in the summary judgment proceedings below. And the deposition transcript is one of these things, what happened next, what happened next, what happened next. No one asked Mr. Green point blank at his deposition, did you object while you were following the agents into the house? And he certainly objected when they got into the house. The other thing on the consent issue that was signed by Mr. Belter, a consent that makes a Fourth Amendment intrusion reasonable, the law has been clear that that can be revoked insofar as the Fourth Amendment is concerned. And it was revoked when Mr. Belter told the agents, you can't come in because the owner's not here. The other point I wanted to make is the consent that the Belter signed was a consent to search, not a consent to unauthorized entry. And there was no reason, there was no case law or other reason to suspect that a consent to search gave the government agents permission to come in unannounced and did away with the knock and announce requirement. And again, I guess with respect to qualified immunity, we come down to the notion that I'm out of time. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wimmer. Our thanks to both Mr. Wimmer and to Mr. Hussack, and the case will be taken under advisement.